are Locked On Pistons, your daily Detroit Pistons podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
4 seconds left. He's got the ball. He should have it. Isaiah hangs on the ball, flips it up to the Raptors. Detroit is the city of champions again.
Detroit basketball.
What up? Welcome to the Locked On Pistons podcast, your episode for Friday, April the 24th, and more with Grecian cutting down the bracket today. This is your boy Matt Shook, the host of the Locked On Pistons podcast, sports writer here in Detroit City covering sports gambling for PlayMichigan.com, Pistons fan and follower my whole life, and a sports newspaper reporter for a decade as well. Thanks for the listen. Thanks for spreading the word about the Locked On Pistons podcast during the pandemic while you're stuck at home. Today, we got all of part two with Grecian Miller cutting the Sweet 16 down to the Elite Eight for the most influential Pistons of all time bracket that we will continue on next week as well. So we need some people to step up and offer to help us out. So email me at matt_shook, S-C-H-O-C-H, at yahoo.com if you're interested in helping out there, or reach out to me on social media as well. Give me a follow at matt_shook, S-C-H-O-C-H, another underscore to that. Also, the Locked On Pistons Twitter account. And check us out on Facebook at Locked On Pistons Dash. Matt Shook, but we just sat through the first round of the Detroit Lions draft. I understand, just from talking to people, I'm probably more down about this team and this regime and this coach than most. I don't know. Maybe being around it kind of sucked the life out of me. Whatever Lions fandom was left, I guess, is probably gone. I think these guys are frauds. And just kind of colored with the past that they have had is just this lack of trading down. And I know that there apparently were no offers out there. And it sounds a lot like the Ed Stefanski trade deadline. That's what kind of popped back into my mind a little bit. But I think there's an art to setting markets, to how you behave as an organization to try to get offers out there. I'm talking more specifically about the Lions in this one. I just think that the way that they handled the rumors about Matthew Stafford and declaring their love for him long term, and I am a Stafford guy, by the way, but you don't have to go out publicly and declare your undying devotion to him so that teams know that you're not going to draft a quarterback. And if there is a possible generational quarterback out there at number four, I know it sounds crazy, but if no one's budging, maybe you just go ahead and draft one of those quarterbacks. Call teams on their bluff. If Miami really wanted him and really gets a feeling at the last minute that you are actually going to draft Tua, then go get him. Or just draft him and see what happens as a team and say, hey, we're going to keep this in our back pocket and see what happens along the way. I feel like a real organization might make a value play like that as opposed to one of a handful of defensive players that could make a contribution, maybe. Okay, I'm out of my element here. We're not going to talk more about the NFL draft today, but it did get me thinking about the Pistons front office. James Edwards III of The Athletic put out the survey this last week. I was a voter in that, by the way. And then I saw the results, a nice article there. I think that might be a good jumping off point to force James to come join us for an interview next week. So to put up the bat signal for him and try to talk to him this weekend. And we will talk Pistons organization and how we feel about what's up for Ed Stefanski's regime heading into year three and just now going into an offseason where they can kind of be properly evaluated, which in my mind is a failure altogether. In that, if anyone's out there can get a nice job for me where you can work 2 years before you ever start to really get evaluated in any kind of meaningful way, I think that would be a great job. So sign me up for something like that that Ed Stefanski seems to be on right now. But let's get to Grecian. We got a long talk with him. Enjoyed it very much so, and I hope you guys do too. But here's Grecian Miller and I talking about the most influential Pistons of all time bracket here on the Locked On Pistons podcast. All right, and we're back with Grecian Miller doing the Sweet 16 of the most influential Pistons of all time bracket. Some tough decisions were made in the first half of the bracket, but here we go with the right side of the bracket. And it gets, again, we talked about Rip and Sheed with how tough that 2-3 matchup is. I think with the 1-4 matchups that we're doing here, and there's a 1-5 matchup a little bit later, I think Ben Wallace versus Jack McCloskey is the toughest 1-4 matchup that we have on the board, maybe closer than some folks might think.
It really is. It really is, because I admit that when the Pistons won their second championship in the Bad Boys, I was 6. So my memories of it live are fleeting. I mean, we knew the name Isaiah Thomas, and he was kind of our Jordan before Jordan. But most of my knowledge comes from it after the fact in the Detroit Bad Boys for Life documentary. But when you go back and look at what Trader Jack had to really do to like get this team together and all of the weird. Like, you know, I mean, it's not even the modern era where you have trades to get the exact right piece. And then you got to ship Dantley out because he's not getting along with Isaiah, even though Dantley's a great player, and how he managed that. And if you when the Pistons walk off from the Bulls with like 13 seconds left and they just leave the court and Jack McCloskey is right there to congratulate them. It's like, I don't care that you're disrespecting the Bulls and that you're leaving before the game's out. You are my guys, and I recognize that this is the end. And he became quickly a really treasured figure for me in that just like you talk about how Joe D built the team for the going to work team, Trader Jack was that guy, and it and really made, I mean, there were a lot of dynamic personalities in the Bad Boys that kind of had to be shoved into one. And then on the other side, we're talking about Ben Wallace. I mean, people were wearing afros to Palace games after he left. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing would chime on a block. I mean, he was never the great offensive player, but as Detroiters, we were trained to watch the defensive side of the ball more. Usually you're watching to see if your team scores, and then you get a drink on the defense side. We're watching the defensive side because Ben Wallace might be guarding three guys at one moment. You know, he might do the right kind of shift and take Shaq one-on-one, and he was listed at 6'9". But if you went to a game, he's shorter than Tayshaun. He's like 6'7". Yeah, you know, and so he is not a big guy, but he could leap and he could get his body around to just do some impossible defense stuff that, I mean, and then honestly, for me, I think if one of the going to work guys has to be a Hall of Famer, it's Ben. He was like a four-time defensive player. He led the league in rebounds twice, at least blocks, I think once. And to a guy with, small hands, like notoriously had very small hands. That's why he was bad at free throws, but he's still this blocked monster. And the Pistons got him on a lark. I mean, he was a throw-in for the Grant Hill trade. Nobody expected him. Joe Dumars admits, like, I did not know this guy was going to be this good. We had no idea. But he really became, like, the figure for the Detroit. Like, he's the only player at the time that my mom would come in and say, like, what's my Warrior doing, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's a really hard one because they're both so vital for their championships. I want to lead towards Ben because it's a players league and that's who you go to, you know, in the after effect. He's still with the Pistons, I think. Isn't he a general manager of the Drive?
Yeah, he's a part owner of the Drive. Yep.
Part owner. Okay. And that he complimented the team where you got Sheed, who's this dynamic mouthpiece, and Ben keeps to himself, doesn't say anything to anybody. You know, he defends himself and picks up a fight when he has to, but he just plays solid defense and keeps the team moving. And so I really, because I watched all of Ben Wallace's Pistons games and I wasn't old enough to watch the Bad Boys, you know, like as a real fan, I want to lean towards Ben, but it's a tough matchup because Jack McCloskey really pulled the genie out of the bottle with getting that team to win too.
Yeah, I agree with everything you say, but I think your best point was the fact that, like, this is a players league and that it's the Pistons and I can remember, you know, the Grant Hill trade and just being like, man, and really it's similar to right now in a lot of ways, like where we're at with this franchise, because it's like, I mean, we could say, are the Detroit Pistons ever going to win another championship? Like, it's conceivable. Like, I mean, like, is this ever, I mean, do you have to, like, just get lucky and fall, you know, ass backwards into LeBron James, like, or the next LeBron James or something like that at this point? I mean, is it even possible? So to have those kind of thoughts in a league that's driven by, you know, Bird and Magic and then Jordan, and then you move on down the list to LeBron these days, and you need Kawhi and Paul George to win it and stuff like that. It's like that's kind of where you were at in 1997 and 99 and in those years. And for Ben Wallace to kind of be, like you said, not only the cultural touchstone of that team, but to be a guy who embodied everything about this franchise and brought this improbable era of mm-hmm. second era of success. When we, like I said, I didn't know that that was ever going to happen. And I'm sitting here right now, I don't know if it's ever going to happen again, you know, and it's possible. And certainly we hope and hope that the right moves are made and some sort of renaissance of this franchise happens, but it's hard. And it's hard work, and yeah. Ben was the one who did it every night out there and kind of set the tone for the organization.
I remember I was watching, of course, I watched, you know, every minute of the 04 finals. Mm-hmm. And I remember afterwards, like, nobody, the Lakers, they didn't talk. Nobody came to media. It was like Devin George was, like, the only guy who actually said things. But weeks later, Shaq took an interview and said, nobody can guard me one-on-one in this mm-hmm. league except Ben Wallace. You know, and he just admitted that he's the only guy that can actually match him. And you got a guy who gives up a lot in weight and height and took down, I mean, the Lakers in the early 2000s, they were unworldly. We thought, are they going to do two three-peats like Jordan's Bulls? Is that mm-hmm. just what the league is? Is the greatest teams do three-peats? And for them to just, and you go back and watch those five games and it stays close, but that fourth quarter, it turns on, and it turns on because Big Ben is back there really marshaling and making sure nobody gets near the bucket. And this is before the three-point was really big, so you're either getting a mid-range off a screen or you're getting to the hole, and nobody got to the hole. I mean, I don't know if we have the word rim protector, you know, without mm-hmm. Ben Wallace. So he really – you know, he really, and Detroit just loved that it was such the dominant underdog story. And they kept it up for years after that and almost won two, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And so, I wanted to say some good things about Trader Jack McCloskey, the late Jack McCloskey, just unbelievable moves. And a lot of these, and me and Breeshner are about the same age. So, you know, the Bad Boys, what we do remember about the Bad Boys are the big moments and the championships mm-hmm. and 007 and stuff. So obviously mm-hmm. the lead up and the moves that they made to get that roster to where it was at are things that are well before my memory. But looking back at some of this stuff, just kind of a trend of not being afraid to cut bait on certain guys, even beloved local guys, and finding guys that are undervalued throughout the league who might be 2, 3, 4, 5 seasons in, and having whatever the mechanism was, whether it was scouts all over the country, however Jack McCloskey found these guys and decided that they had the DNA to be the type of players that he wanted to bring to the Bad Boys. I'm looking at Bill Laimbeer and Kenny Carr for Phil Hubbard, Paul McCaskey, and a first-round pick and a second-round pick. That first-round pick ended up being the 12th pick in the draft in 1982. John Bagley, who had some good, relevant yeah. NBA times in the 1980s. Of course, Bill Laimbeer goes to 4 All-Star games in the next 5 years with the Pistons and just has the career that he has, undervalued with the Cleveland Cavaliers in just basically two seasons. Vinnie Johnson with the Seattle Supersonics. He was with them for 3 years. The 7th pick of the 1979 draft, obviously someone who was valued very highly around the league. Jack gets him straight up for Greg Kelcer, who's a Detroiter who is, you know, Special K. I mean, he's beloved mm-hmm. in Michigan mm-hmm. State with his days. Greg ended up only having 4 more years in the league. His career is over at age 27. Obviously, the knees that he had is right. a big part of that. But to cut bait with a Detroiter, with a Michigan State guy, with Isaiah's friend, Greg Kelcer, to bring in Vinnie Johnson. That's a courageous move to bring in Vinnie Johnson. We know about the career that he has. Rick Mahorn yeah. plays 5 years with the Washington Bullets. He was fizzling out. He had kind of a good second and third year with them. By his 5th year with Washington, his numbers are down, his minutes are down, and Jack McCloskey brings him in. He trades, he requires Mahorn and Mike Gibson for Dan Roundfield, who he's a Central Michigan guy. He went to Detroit Chadsey. He's in his early 30s at this point. Kind of tough to trade a guy who's scoring and doing a lot of the things that you know, gets the fans through the turnstiles. You bring in Rick Mahorn, a younger guy at that time, and obviously he becomes another cultural touchstone, another tone setter for the organization. Dan Ronfield was 32 at that time. He played two more seasons with the league, and that was it. So McCloskey makes great moves. He nails the draft picks. You know, Joe Dumars, Dennis Rodman in the second round, John Sally. These are great picks. And also, as I'm looking through kind of some of the draft history, obviously you nail Isaiah in 81 at number two. But then you draft Cliff Levingston, you draft Antoine Carr, you draft Tony Campbell, who ended up playing against the Pistons with the Lakers in the finals in 89. You're not afraid to trade those guys. He doesn't get married to guys, and he trades them and moves on and cuts bait. So even his questionable moves are ones that he's not afraid to kind of move on from. Joe Dumars, he sees at number 18 in the draft in 85. Unbelievable. One of the best drafts of all time. And keeps him and turns him into the Hall of Famer that he is. John Sally, number 11 out of Georgia Tech. And then, there wasn't a lot that they were able to get with some of those late picks with the 30s and the late 20s when the Pistons were rolling. But just a pristine record for McCloskey in kind of, it's tough. And, you know, to have nine guys like they did the second or the first championship, and then basically an 8-man rotation for the second championship of guys that could have been second or third or fourth best players on a lot of teams in the league that are coming off the bench for this team. So McCloskey was great is my long way of saying that.
Absolutely. I mean, Lambeer plus Mahorn is why the Bad Boys name exists, mm-hmm. You know, and to,
the poster,
and to pull a
the
player.
Poster from 7-Eleven.
The poster, exactly. The
yes, sir!
Breishan, let's talk Grant Hill, the 3 seed against Bill Lambeer, the 2nd seed. Like a dynamic superstar type player, the best player clearly on his era of Pistons basketball, against a guy who's, you know, the kind of, like we said, the cultural touchstone, tone setter, protector of Isaiah, you know, all those mm-hmm. all those things that Lambeer was. It's tough to compare two guys that are very different, but obviously were very impactful for the Pistons organization.
Yeah, this is another one I really mourned over, because Grant Hill's time in Detroit really goes unlooked, because the team mm-hmm. never got to the heights it could have. But Grant Hill was ushered in as like, here's the next Jordan, especially because his greatest years were when Jordan was retired. Those 2 years he was gone. And you look at the highlights of Grant Hill and you think that he could have been something. It's just, it's really, we didn't have the training mindset, the scientific kind of way to go about keeping this guy preserved, that he spent a lot of time injured. And so by the time he got traded, it felt like, well, Grant Hill, he can't get healthy, but you watch him play and you watch the things he did. And it's like, man, what could have been if he could have stuck with the team and been this guy, because he was really not on a great Pistons team in the mid 90s, but probably the best player in the league outside yeah. of Jordan for that era. I mean, this is a really dynamic player who kind of, he was like a Scottie Pippen, but the star player, to where he can move around the court. He can shoot from anywhere. He can handle the ball. He can get all the rebounds, you know, that amazing block and dunk over Alonzo Mourning mm-hmm. when Detroiters called him soft. And you always go back to that video of what he had, and then that he rewrote his career afterwards to prove that he was a really great, you know, talent for the team. So I hate that Grant Hill is put in a bad era of Pistons. Mm-hmm. But I want to make this Lambeer's win, because who the Pistons were in that era, in the late 80s, early 90s, in terms of like, we're the team that's going to throw you down. We're the team you're going to hate to play against. You're going to have to do some extra push-ups before you come towards us. You know, I mean, that was off Bill Lambeer. I've heard older fans, like, say, my father's age, who didn't live in Michigan, to say, oh, Bill Lambeer, that that scam artist, that people like had a vehement hate towards Lambeer because how he would screw teams over. And he'd play the mind games to where like, I'm going to kind of foul you this time, but then I'm going to hard foul you the next time. It like get you really thinking if you're ready for this game. And he was ruthless. He was ruthless in breaking a team down. And that first, that 88 championship that the Pistons lost, and we've all gone back and watched the play where he supposedly fouls Kareem and Kareem makes the free throws to win the game, but he clearly doesn't even touch him. Based off of, they called the foul because of course Lambeer fouled him. Lambeer always fouls him. And so that was all off his reputation. He owned up to saying, I'm the one who wants to walk off from the Bulls. You know, we're not going to even play the last 10 seconds of the game. So much of Bill Lambeer's kind of audacity to say, you know what, screw you, I matter right now. And that, I mean, you kind of have, you've got a 6-foot point guard who is really going into the trees. This was the era where you needed enforcers. For the Pacers, it was the Davis brothers, you know. For us, it was Lambeer and Mahorn. You needed those guys to throw people around when they started going after your little guys. It was almost a hockey type thing. And we don't do that anymore. And so, I mean, and then you go on, and he predated Greg Kelser in terms of the color commentator. I mean, I know the WNBA doesn't come into play for our arguments, but he really, you know, stayed with the team and was a great figure around it. So I want to lean towards Lambeer. I just hate that. I mean, Grant Hill, it's kind of like with the Sheed argument. Grant Hill, I mean, this could have been a dynasty if given the right time and the right players, because Grant Hill was just head and shoulders above the rest of the team.
Yeah, he played 6 seasons in Detroit, obviously the very beginning of his career, averaged 21.6 points per game in those 6, and then went on the rest of his career, never had a season that he averaged over 20 after that, despite getting close when his one real good year with Orlando. Yeah, the year after he sat out the entire season in 03-04, 25.8 points per game in his final season with the Pistons. His final season with the Pistons was his best season in the league, definitely statistically and anecdotally as well. Became a little bit of a three-point shooter that year with 34.7% on, you know, decent amount of attempts, only not too many, obviously, but a different time and a different type of player. But I think with Bill, and you mentioned, I agree completely with all you said about Bill Lambeer, but I'll throw this in, a little bit more, you know, skilled than maybe he gets credit for in retrospect, especially those three-pointers. And this is, again, before they were big in the NBA, he was hitting them. He was hitting at 34.9% in 89, the first championship, and then 90, he goes to 36% at 2 attempts per game, which is a lot back then. For a center, I mean, obviously for a center, it was an astronomical amount. Big three-pointers in the playoffs as well. And you remember, I mean, just couldn't look more unathletic when he was shooting three-pointers. Just like an unbelievable, like, shuffling type of jump. And obviously his hands way above his head. Just an iconic stroke that we'll kind of never forget. But in addition to what you said about setting the tone defensively, leadership, running the locker room, setting the tone, like you said, playoff numbers, ups the three-point marks to over 2 per game in 89 at 35.7% and then 35% again in 90, and a lot of big shots in there too. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's Lambeer, but like you said, tough the way that Grant Hill's career ended up. But I think, like, as we talk about Grant Hill, you know, he goes in the Hall of Fame last year, I think he gets his due. And I think people like us who know his whole career respect his game and think of him as someone that, while the career numbers and the career accomplishments won't be what they could have been because of the injuries that he had a third of the way through his career, I think that everyone kind of knows what kind of talent he was.
Yeah, I loved seeing him in the later years with Phoenix and the Clippers, saying like, see, Grant Hill still got it. He's still an important member on a team, even old after injuries. But
became a defensive standout at the end of his career.
Right.
And always someone that you could rely on with the ball in his hands. Certainly he wasn't a big time scorer in those years with Phoenix and LA, but like you said, very trustworthy guy to have on the court in big moments for sure. And I think that's a credit to a guy who's able, who, you know, did all he did and then obviously battled back with the ankles and the surgeries and some of the scary stories that you heard after the fact about some things that he went through with that. And to, you know, to psychologically just become a great role player on some very good teams is quite an accomplishment for him. But Bill Laimbeer moves on, as you would imagine. Bill versus Ben Wallace next round to get to the Final Four. Unbelievable. But how about Isaiah versus George Blaha, 1 versus 5? That's a tough one because it's George Blaha. But, you know, it's got to be Isaiah, right?
It's absolutely got to be Isaiah. I mean, Zeke is the best player to have ever played for the Pistons.
I
mean, that should go without saying. You know, we should have been on the dream team. There were, you know, personality problems. But, I mean, he's the first little guy. I mean, little, he's taller than me, 6 foot, you know. But he's the first guard to run a team and be the leading scorer. You know, he's got so many historic moments with the team. The Pistons don't have, you know, we were calling Isaiah before we were calling Jordan. We were just little kids trying to shoot shots. I mean, Isaiah Thomas is who the Pistons are in a lot of ways. And so it's kind of heartwarming that Blaha has to lose to Isaiah, because I don't know. I have never watched a Pistons game that in the regular season that Blaha wasn't the commentator. You know, when I'd be walking down and I'd pass, you know, a cafeteria or a Coney, and they'd have the game play, and I was like, oh, that was Blaha, the game's on. And I'd run into the Coney to see it, because, you know, you hear count that baby in a foul and, you know, 4.5 to play in the half and all of his phrases and how beloved he was by all of his teams and how much he loves talking. It really bleeds Detroit, and that he's still going. I mean, I don't know how old Blaha is, but he's got to be 73, 74, something like that. And so it's really, I mean, it's going to be a sad day when he finally isn't the commentator for whatever reasons, but he's seen the Pistons through every step, and he calls it real. He's like, the Pistons got a long way to go if they want to win this game, you know, but he keeps it upbeat. And so, but you can't put him over Isaiah. He'd probably call you on the phone the next day to bitch you out, you know, that you put him over Isaiah, because Isaiah Thomas was, you know, he wasn't the bad boys in terms of like the heart and the defense and the getting in the scuffles and the throwing guys around, but just being able to run the offense and score at any time and hold his own position. And I, every year I watch that 88 game, even though they lost eventually, just because he's doing that when his foot is too big for his shoe. His ankle is swollen so bad. Like, he's running around the court, and then we watch him go back to the bench, he's hobbling. But on the court, he's fine. You know, just the pure heart. And I love the line from that documentary when he, I think it was his Achilles he tore, that because he retired early at like 33 and said, he looks in the camera and said, I had nothing left to give. I mean, he gave so much, you know, from the city. He was like from Chicago, which, you know, I mean, it's close enough as far as Midwestern grit and like, you know, being of Detroit. Isaiah just has so much to do. I mean, I don't know his career scoring averages, but I know a lot of them haven't been beaten yet.
Yeah, so 13 seasons, all with the Detroit Pistons, and like you said, the Achilles in 93-94, which ended his career there in his early 30s, but made 12 All-Star teams up until the very last season, with the only year that he didn't make the All-Star team. Obviously a slam dunk Hall of Famer, but you know, something that isn't really talked about with Isaiah that I think is kind of parallel to another Detroit athlete, and I kind of liken him a little bit to Steve Yzerman, because when Yzerman comes in, it's like the stats are kind of jumping off the page to you, right? I mean, some of the seasons that Yzerman had numbers-wise, and I'm looking at Isaiah's basketball reference page right now, second year in the league, 22.9 points per game. He led the league in assists in 84-85. This is a league that has you know, Magic and Stockton and Mark Jackson and all these, you know, transcendent pass first point guards. And Isaiah's a guy getting 20 plus a game and getting 14 assists a game. So the usage that he had, the amount of touches that he had, the offense went through him completely. But, you know, so he has his 17 points per game as a rookie, then goes 5 years in a row with 20 points or more, and then never scored 20 points per game for the rest of his career in the NBA. But guess what? When he drops down to 19.5 is 1987-88 when they make the finals. And then they win the two championships the year after that, 18 per game from there. So my point is that he kind of defers a little bit as Joe Dumars becomes Joe Dumars, as you add Mark Aguirre to the offense, as you know, guys come and go in terms of the, you know, James Edwards gets some touches when he joins the starting lineup. You know, guys that come off the bench get a lot of these hustle points, and Rodman and Sally off the bench, and Laimbeer gets his touches. Isaiah maybe doesn't get enough credit for the deferment that he did, and obviously stepping up in the fourth quarter and making pretty much all the big plays when needed. I shouldn't say that. That probably undersells guys like Vinny Johnson and Joe Dumars in clutch moments. But you knew that the ball was going to be in Isaiah's hands at the end when it was time to either make a shot or set up Vinny Johnson for 007 or whatever it was. So, you know, Yzerman, kind of the narrative of Yzerman is that when he became the leader, when he became not just the best player on the team, but the center of the locker room, that kind of helped the Red Wings, and especially when these other guys around him, Fedorov and whoever, blossoms as players. I think Isaiah kind of has that same narrative a part of his career as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And people forget that before the Pistons were the defensive monster they were, in those mid-80s, they were a high-scoring team. I mean, highest-scoring game in the league is the Pistons versus Denver in, like, triple overtime, 180, I don't remember how much, but it's like 186 to 184, and I'm pretty sure Trepuka was still on the team at that point. And Isaiah's is getting monster assists and dishing out to the guys to where you're just scoring, you know, ad nauseum, you know, so he could lead a high powered offense. That's just not what it took to actually win the thing at the end.
And let's end with a tough one here. Obviously, Vinny Johnson, probably the greatest play in Pistons history, 007 to win the second championship. Although, you know, a little bit of revisionist history. You got the fact that it's game five, and you know, you probably win six or seven at home, even if he doesn't make it. And they're tied at the time, too. So it's not like a do or die, losing your, you know, missing you lose kind of thing. And of course, Daddy Rich, Chuck Daly, the legacy is, you know, you don't, there's not much that needs to be said about Chuck and how he kind of managed the egos of that team. You know, for all the positive things we talk about with the Bad Boys, and how they channeled everything, and a lot of people get credit for that. But I think Chuck probably deserves the most credit for that, because he, you know, that could have gone sideways very easily.
Oh, yeah,
we've seen teams around the league, you know, that have strong personalities where things don't move in the right direction. And Chuck certainly made it happen for Detroit.
Yeah, this was the hardest one for me. I didn't really come to a conclusion, because at any point, if you take Dumars or even Isaiah out of the equation, Vinny could have started for either of those guards. And he made sure to let them know that, you know, that, you know, I could take your position, and that, you know, in 89 and 90 and in those days, a microwave was kind of a more novel, you know, appliance. It wasn't a staple like it is now. And the fact that he did, he got on the court and he's scoring. He's immediately scoring, kind of like in the 05 Pistons, to where they can't score, and then McDyess comes on the play and he's hitting those mid-range jumpers to score. He was instant offense, and it's a beautiful play to watch when he hits it with 0.07 left. And you go back to watch a lot of those games, and a lot of times he really recharges the team and becomes the reason they win in an unspoken way. So, I mean, to put the microwave down is really hard, because it is a player's league, but Chuck Daly was the perfect, he needed to be the coach for this team to be as great as it was and to win two championships, because he had this kind of cool, relaxed way of just dealing with everybody, and this is how it is. But at the same time, when the players are like getting at each other on the bus, because they say, all right, shut up, we're talking about the game. Here's what you got to do. I'm done. We did it in practice. I don't need to coach you anymore. Play the game. You know, he just had this really kind of a coach nowadays has to more micromanage, be very culture heavy, and do little things right here. And in those old school days, you could be everybody's best friend and then say, shut up and do your job. And they would know what to do. So I remember I moved back to Kalamazoo at that point. It's like 07, 08 when Chuck Daly died. And I looked at, like, you know, his winning records with the team, and that he did go to coach the All-Star game several times, of course, coach the Dream Team, and that he could do the things to make a team is like, okay, you're this bunch of talent. You only need two things to win, and then I'm done. Here you go. And so this is a hard one for me, because I don't think Vinnie Johnson goes unheralded a lot of ways, but I don't think the Pistons win without him. I really don't. And so, yeah. But I mean, for Chuck to be able to navigate, like we said earlier, with Aguirre saying that Rodman should start over him, and all of these differences, like, I mean, like how Dantley and Isaiah were at each other's heads, you know, for him to manage that, I'm kind of leaning towards him now that I talked myself into it.
Yeah, it's. I think that's the point that I kind of keep coming back to is, and really, also, we got to once again shout out first Bill Davidson and Jack McCloskey for putting the trust into Chuck Daly, because they knew they were building a kind of a monster there. And this was a guy who, you know, Punxsutawney High School, and then mm-hmm. went to obviously where Groundhog Day is goes mm-hmm. on. There in Pennsylvania, but ends up at Boston College and Penn, becomes an assistant with the Philadelphia 76ers, coached Ed Stefanski at Penn, I believe, too. Which
oh,
is
wow, I didn't know that. That's
yeah,
crazy.
But he gets to the NBA and assistant with the 76ers, but has one season as a head coach with the Cleveland Cavaliers, and only has 41 games that year, so 9-32. So to put the trust in a guy who a couple years ago was 9-32 as the head coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers, and then ends up getting the job with the Pistons. I mean, this feels like a situation where, like, Rick Carlisle comes in, right? And he kind of mm-hmm. like helps build the team, but then you kind of bring in the Larry Brown type at the end to put you over the top.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That more veteran coach for him to go through that progression of literally nobody in the NBA, a guy who's coached 41 games as a head coach, 9-32, to come in and deal with those personalities, to grow as a coach with Isaiah Thomas, with Joe Dumars, never coached a losing season for the Pistons, 48-34 before he moves on to New Jersey. And then, you know, not great New Jersey teams, but winning records for both of those years. And then in the post Shaq Orlando days, after he leaves for LA, he coaches a season and a half with Orlando, actually two seasons, and goes 500 and then finishes 33-17 in his final year in the NBA. So that one season with Cleveland was his one year where he was under 500, so didn't coach bad teams. Obviously, there's something to be said for picking your spots there too. But I just think that the way he handled that roster and you know, Dennis Rodman, like you said correctly, that talked about him as like a father figure, but also – obviously, there's probably untold things that happened behind the scenes that he had to manage, to whether it was fights at practice. We know that Bill Laimbeer broke his hand, mm-hmm. That Isaiah broke his hand punching Bill Laimbeer. So I'm sure that yep. other things like that happened over the years as well. So I just think that and Vinny's Vinny, and a guy, another tough guy to kind of move on from. But man, it's tough to have Chuck lose. So I'm gonna vote for Chuck to win in this one as well.
Yeah, I hear you, and I feel that, like we've said, that it is a player's league, but when you have a management or a coach that's dynamic enough that the casual fan remembers his name, yeah, he should move on, you know? Mm-hmm. Because I think Flip, who I love, has a better record than Chuck Daly, but it wasn't until that point that somebody had a better record with the Pistons. I might be wrong on my stats there, but he kept the winning record for quite a while.
Yeah, and just 467 wins, 271 losses for the Pistons, and then throw one, 467 wins, 271 losses. That was games in there. And then in the playoffs, 71-42. In, by the way, talking about 71-42 in kind of the golden age of the NBA, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we're talking about some of the most, the toughest opponents that you could possibly face year after year after year, round after round after round. So that's it. I mean, that's, we've got the Elite Eight, and Elite is, it's going to be even tougher to do this next week. We're going to have Joe D against Bill Davidson, 1-2.
Wow.
Chauncey and Rip, 1-3. The point guard backcourt against each other. Ben Wallace and Bill Laimbeer is perfect because it's like the same, you know, kind of character on two different eras.
For each team,
And then Isaiah versus Chuck. So, I mean, doesn't get much better than that to try to get to the Final Four. So, any closing thoughts for us, Breishan, as we kind of close the book on the Sweet 16?
No, I like how the matchups led up, and that we're at least putting our hearts out and saying who the Pistons matter. For how my lineage went, I wish that the Stackhouse, Hill, Carlisle Pistons, I think they get a ring, you know, regardless of what Joe D does. I just want to point that team out, that this team was on the arc, you know. Larry Brown came in and sealed the deal for sure, but I think this team gets a championship either way. They had the same potential, and that gets lost, you know, because, you know, those Carlisle, Stackhouse, Grant Hill teams were just as good. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, that's a great point, that all those guys are out of the Elite Eight at this point. I think that the especially Grant Hill, how great he was, and like you said, Stackhouse, you know, there's nothing to say that they don't still win titles with Jerry Stackhouse instead of Rip Hamilton. And then Rick Carlisle obviously goes on to win his own title with the Dallas Mavericks. So it was possible. And Carlisle's issues were more behind the scenes and nothing against his coaching abilities that led to his demise in Detroit. So those are good points. But I mean, we're talking about the two eras. I mean, you got to be at this point in this tournament, you're either a bad boy or you're a going to work staple or you're Bill Davidson and you're, who's involved in both, and Joe Dumars, obviously.
Right. Because that's when the Pistons, that was the two glory eras, and now we've had a very long dry era, and it's going to take a guy with that kind of courage and that kind of magic luck to pull us out of it. I really think it is. I don't think you just do this the pedantic San Antonio way. I think you've got to capture the genie in the bottle to get it in Detroit, you know?
Well, Breishan, I really enjoyed this. Thanks. You did a great job helping us out, and we really appreciate it. Give him a follow on Twitter at Brishen and Miller, regular spelling there, out in Philly, big Pistons fan. And enjoy chopping it up with you about the Pistons, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Absolutely. I listen every day. Thanks, Matt.
All right, and thanks again to Breishan for helping us out. Give him a follow on Twitter. Breishan is Brishen, and Miller, regular spelling. Appreciate him, and still looking for some people to help us out with the next few weeks. So we'd appreciate if you guys would reach out to me at Matt_Shook, S-C-H-O-C-H, another underscore after that on Twitter, and also Matt_Shook@yahoo.com is the email address as well. But that'll do it for me. Have a great weekend, everyone. Enjoy the rest of the NFL draft. Looking forward to speaking to you guys next week. Stay home, stay safe, and enjoy the weekend. This is your host, Matt Shook, saying go ahead and tell your smart device to play the most recent episode of Locked On NBA. Have a great weekend, everyone. Talk to you guys on Monday.